Welcome to the Untoxicated Podcast.
Well, I'm Sherry Salas, and that was my husband, Matt.
We have questions about the impact of alcohol and addiction on relationships.
If you have those kinds of questions, too, you're in the right place.
Here we go.
Table episode, Sherry. We have friends on today.
Yes.
Good friends, actually.
Yeah, and I'm super excited.
Yeah.
So it's not just my voice.
Yeah.
That everyone will hear about the topic that you so love.
What's the topic?
Intimacy. Sexual intimacy.
Sex and intimacy in an alcoholic relationship. We never talk about that. Well, it's great to have people joining us. Nikki, Renee, and Nicole, welcome. And for some of you, welcome back to the Untoxicated Podcast. Glad to have you on this roundtable discussion with us.
Hi, Matt.
Thanks. Thanks, Nikki. It's good to have you. Everyone else is waving. Great. So before we turn it over to you guys and start asking questions, this is a topic that we've talked about a lot. This episode is from the partner's perspective, how alcoholism has impacted physical intimacy, emotional intimacy, and sexual satisfaction from the partner's perspective, because all three of you are not the drinker. I'm the only former problematic drinker on the call. Everyone else is the partners. And we just want to kind of hear what has happened in your relationship and how intimacy has been impacted. Sherry and I have come to believe that there are two ways that sex and intimacy can go in an alcoholic relationship. The first way, the way it went for Sherry and I, is that the physical contact keeps on going, and it becomes really toxic. There are times when we would continue to have sexual contact that, Sherry, you were doing it for a variety of reasons. Like I think you've talked about in the past, it was almost kind of the easier choice sometimes, right? Rather than looking at me, waiting for me to pout and whine and argue and be just a pest. Is that a fair way to put that?
Yeah, that's a fair way to put that.
Yeah. And keep us from arguing all night sometimes.
Yep.
It was just the lesser of two evils.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You got a lot of words about this today.
A lot of words out there before it. So, I mean, those were the ways I would describe it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to add?
Well, not nearly as classy, but it was to like shut your whiny drunk ass up. But, you know, and hopefully you would pass out after. And then I didn't have to worry about you waking up and like wanting it, you know?
Yeah.
So it was just kind of a routine that we kind of fell into of appeasement.
Appeasement. That's a good word. Yeah. I know I've used the word coercion in the past, and that is that's a really hard word for me to own up to, but I think it's accurate. And I think it's that's a painful word for our listeners to relate to. I know, coercion and rape are not the same thing, but they kind of they're a little too close together for a lot of people's comfort. Certainly for my comfort, I'm disgusted with myself and really regret a lot of the begging and pleading and cajoling and saying things like, you know, you're my wife, so you owe, you know, not you owe this. I don't think I ever said that, did I? But you're my wife, and this is part of being married.
Yeah.
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 And I know the feelings for you, not the greatest either, right? Because you were agreeing to do this sacred, loving thing in a way that was neither sacred nor loving for you.
Yeah. Also, I just, you know, the more that you asked and the more that you needed. And I mean, now I understand that there are different levels of, it's not early enough. It's too early.
You don't have enough coffee yet.
Yeah. Last week I was on it because it was later in the day. Like our levels of sexual
libido. Yes. Sexual desire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like yours was off, but I just felt like it was selfishness. And so then there was a lot of
research. Wait, when you say mine was off, mine was different from yours.
Yeah. So yours was different than mine.
Mine was higher than yours.
Yeah. We were just, you know, off. And I just felt like that was selfishness. And I thought it was greedy. And I just thought, well, you know, you could probably sacrifice not to have it so much, but you did. And I didn't know that you were missing something, like an emotional connection that you were trying to gain through the physical connection along with the higher libido. I mean, looking back now, I can put the pieces together, but, you know, I just felt like it was just pure selfishness, and I lost respect for you. So that's something, like, it's really hard to perform when you have no respect for the person.
And that's a big thing to come back from. And for a long time, I thought when we say there are two ways sex and intimacy can go in an alcoholic relationship, I thought that was the worst of the two, because we had all that toxicity and all that resentment, mm-hmm. and, you know, you feeling like I was selfish, and, you know, me having lots of shame and self-blame around it as well. So I thought that was the hardest thing to come back from. But what I think we're learning now, the other way that sex and intimacy can go in an alcoholic relationship, if you get over the hump to sobriety and both partners are working on recovery, the other way it can go might even be harder to come back from. And that's when the physical contact stops altogether during active addiction, and both partners just write it off and say, you know, maybe the drinker, you know, would like that contact, would like that emotional and physical connection, but has faced rejection so many times that they've given up. And certainly understandable, your perspective, the, as the loved one, it's just, it's not attractive. It's not of interest. And it's kind of the last thing on your mind. And so for those couples where it has gone away altogether, that is another option, and perhaps the hardest one to come back from. I don't know. But we'll bring our roundtable in and hear what they have to say for sure. So let's get your guys' stories. And if there's a third way that we don't know about, feel free to contradict us. Nikki, let's start with you. What happened in your relationship as the drinking ramped up as it relates to sex and intimacy? What was your experience?
Well, so when my husband was in the worst part of his drinking, when he had crossed over into alcoholism, I didn't know it. I hadn't realized it. So he was secretly drinking, and he was doing a really good job at that. But what I noticed was that I was being treated worse and worse and worse as time was going on. So I was being treated really poorly, and I didn't know why. So you talk about libidos. My husband's is higher than mine, usual, you know, on any given day. So my desire to have sex with him just went down and down and down as I was being treated worse. So that was sort of like the natural occurrence that's going to happen when your relationship is falling apart, I think. He would try to talk to me about it too. And same thing that you and Sherry were saying, that he said he gets an emotional connection from the physical connection, and he really needed that. And you know, every once in a while, I'd try to throw him a bone or something, you know, but no pun intended, sorry. But yeah, it was just getting worse and worse. And then on top of the sex itself, it was like just the intimacy that two people have in a marriage that was getting worse. So just touching each other, kissing each other, hugging each other, you know, the little slaps on the butt that you do when you walk by each other, those were all going away too. The intimate talks that we would have, those were all going away. Like all of the intimacy, including the sexual intimacy, was just going right down the drain. So our connection was just getting farther and farther and farther apart. So here, the difference is my husband wanted to have sex to bring that connection back together. And the further the connection got for me, the less I wanted to have sex. So there was a lot of arguing, a lot of fighting during that time. And yeah, there were times that I would give into it, but I didn't really want to do it. And the more the time went by, the less and less I gave in. Finally, my husband just told me that he came to the conclusion that he was tired of being rejected, and that he didn't want to argue with me about it anymore, and he wasn't going to bring it up anymore. And that's when it completely stopped. So sex completely stopped at that point. When I found out that he was drinking, I found out that he had become an alcoholic, and he'd been lying to me for all those years. That's when the trust issue happened for me. So on top of being treated poorly, now I didn't trust him. So things kind of got worse, even though he did quit drinking, he got sober. So he's been 15 months sober now. And we're working on it, but it is really difficult. And I'm having a really hard time trusting him again to go back into to have a physical relationship with him again. So it's, you know, we're starting out really, really slow because like everything disappeared. So it's almost like we're trying to date each other again or something, but we live together. So it's a little odd. And I have to remind myself, you know, I have to touch him, to kiss him, to hug him, because it's not that natural feeling that you have for somebody when you're married to them and you love them is, you know, is buried. I know it's in there somewhere, but it's just so buried under all of this deceit and like the loneliness that I felt and, you know, all of those bad emotions that you feel when you're living with an active alcoholic.
That's so interesting that you've really experienced both sides of this, in that you had that pattern that Sherry and I had for a period. And then you also had the no contact period. I can't tell you how common what you're sharing is from the perspective of once it's gone, restarting is really, really hard. I mean, Sherry and I have all this damage to deal with, but we never stopped being physically active with each other. So we don't have to get over that hump. And I have a ton of empathy for what you're sharing. What, like, how long was the period from when he was still drinking, when he said, I can't take the rejection anymore, and he stopped asking and you guys just stopped? How long during his active addiction was that? Was that months or years or?
I think it's about 6 months. Yeah. Okay. The last 6 months of his drinking.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've definitely had some of it all.
Well, and I was just going to jump in and say that it becomes a habit for like that, you know, that connection. You know, I stopped doing that long ago, just giving Matt hugs or asking him to rub my back, or, you know, if I had like a sore back. You know, we have four kids and I've been pregnant four times. That's a lot of back pain. But because every time I asked or showed any affection, you thought it was going to turn into a happy ending. And so I just started withdrawing and not giving you any of that. As Nikki said, throw you a bone every once in a while, but I couldn't even like give you a nice little hug, you know, if something good was going, because I was afraid you were going to like make it turn into sex. So then when you don't do that, it not just like removing sexual experiences together, you know, out of the picture, it's those little connections, like Nikki was saying, you know, those little intimate moments that are just little signs of affection.
Yeah.
And that's a hard habit to get back into, even if sex has been something that you've continued to do.
Yeah. Well, that's a great lead. And I wanted to follow up, Nikki. I'm curious, you said it's like you're dating again, even though you live together, but you've also got this track record. So I know Sherry and I almost felt like, you know, we have no interest in starting over and finding other partners, but do you think it's even harder than that? Like, would it almost be easier to start over fresh with somebody that you don't have this negative baggage that you've got to deal with. What's your response to that?
Yeah, I agree. It's really, I think it would be easier to try to start a brand new relationship with a brand new partner. That would definitely be easier than what's happening now. Because when you start with a brand new partner, you have a clean slate. You know, they haven't done anything to you yet. They haven't, misused your trust. They haven't, lied. They haven't deceived you. They haven't, none of those things have happened. So the problem is, it's not that I don't love my husband. I do. I love him and I'm proud of him for being sober. He's doing a great job. And it's not that I'm not physically attracted to him. I mean, he's a really good looking guy. I look at him and I'm like, oh yeah, he's a really good looking guy, you know? And it's the lack of trust and the lost respect that I'm having to build back like brick by brick. So it's not about, oh, he stopped drinking, so everything's back to normal now. It's not even close to that. So, it's got to be, we've talked about this in Echoes that it needs to be multiple things need to happen. So, it needs to, just like how it fell apart, bit by bit, that's how it has to come back. Brick by brick by brick, you got to build it back. And it's time, just tons of time and making new positive memories to try to overlay those negative ones. So that's the hardest part is you can forgive, but forgetting is impossible. I can't forget all of those things that I went through and all of I know we're not getting into all of that, but all the gaslighting and the lying and all of that, all of those things, that's very difficult. And so, So anyways, and the habit of just not being physical. So we get along great now. We don't argue. We're back in those very early stages of courting somebody, right? Where you're making jokes and everything's funny and you're looking forward to spending time together. So that's sort of where we're at, but we're sleeping in the same bed, living in the same house.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's really, really powerful. Everything that you're sharing, you've said the word trust, I think 3 times now, and we're going to talk more, later in the episode. I've got some more questions about that connection between trust and intimacy and what y'all think about that. So we'll come back to it. But I think it's very interesting that you've used the word trust a few times already. Thank you very much, Nikki, for leading off. Renee, we would love to hear your story about your experiences with intimacy with you and your partner. Welcome to the Untoxicated Podcast, Renee.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So tell us what it's been like.
Oh, what it's been like. Pretty awful, actually. So my partner and I met through my family, actually. My stepmother and uncle had known my partner for like 30 years. And I told him from the beginning, there has to be something to the way we met and exactly when we met. Because I had been married for 20 years and I had left my husband and I was away from my husband, 6 months maybe, when my partner and I met. And he was married for a long time as well. And he had rented an apartment in my stepmother's building. And everyone had said, how had you guys never met before this? How is that even possible? Well, it was possible. We met right at the time that we were supposed to meet. And we started, kind of as friends. We were both helping out my stepmother with a garage sale, believe it or not, and spending a lot of time together, having a good time. And, it's interesting. We were both drinking quite a bit when we met. I had been a social drinker since I was, we'll say 21, but really before that, it's just kind of, you know, ignore that part. But for me, it had never been something that altered my life. It was just, you know, I used to go out a lot. I used to go out dancing. I used to go to dinner. I had a pretty big social circle. So I would drink socially. I would go out and drink and eat and dance and just have a good time. So, you know, our drinking was just really social and fun at first. It was summertime. We were having a garage sale. And then we started dating. We started spending even more time together. And I noticed that the drinking was affecting our relationship, was definitely affecting our intimacy. But it took me a minute to make that connection that the drinking was really affecting him. Because to me, since I also drank socially and had a good time, I didn't really find it to be such an issue. You know, it didn't exactly click that this was a problem for him. But back to the intimacy part, I found that we were not always on the same page with intimacy. I actually wanted it more frequently than he did. And he only seemed to really want it when he was drinking or drunk. And that was an issue for me because that was when I found him to be absolutely the least attractive, you know. And it would affect certain things like, you know, not to be too graphic, but I would kind of ask for certain things and kind of lean towards certain things. And he wouldn't exactly be able to do it. I think he just didn't have the coordination. You know what I mean? I don't think he had the control and coordination to make it happen in any way other than what he was just used to doing. So that was part of it.
Sure.
And then our relationship continued. He started drinking on more of a daily basis. And what really kind of tipped the scale for me was, by that point, some months had passed, we had opened a business together. And it was Memorial Day weekend. It was before noon. He was already drunk and decided to go out on his motorcycle for a ride. And there was nothing I could do to stop him. So he leaves. I'm stuck, you know, with this business that I'm now running by myself because he's drunk riding around on a motorcycle. And I get a call from him that he had an accident, fell off his motorcycle, and dislocated his shoulder, and now I have to go get him. Okay, great. So now I have furniture outside my business on the sidewalk that I have to leave there to go and find this man who crashed his motorcycle. Okay, that sounds like really what I'm supposed to be doing instead of running my business. But all right. So what happened after that was very concerning. He made every excuse known to man about why he crashed, and none of them had anything to do with alcohol. Complete denial, complete deflection. One day he said he was speeding. The next day he said he wasn't going that fast. He doesn't know how it happened because he wasn't going that fast. It had nothing to do with alcohol. So for some time after that, he couldn't work, which again is a problem when you're running a furniture business and you have to move everything. He does another very physical job that he couldn't do. So it's affecting our business. It's affecting his main source of income. And he refused to believe in any way that it had to do with his drinking.
Did that impact your intimate connection, the respect
of his
trust? Yeah, all of that.
It's affected every aspect of our lives. It affects the trust that I have for him. It affected our intimacy. And the denial is still ongoing. It got to the point where we had even less intimacy. I just felt so rejected because when he wasn't drunk and I would try and initiate, I would get pushed away. And then he came and lived here with me, and that lasted only less than 6 months. And we've been apart physically now for a year. We were still, you know, in touch a lot, talking almost every day. Again, with really almost no intimacy. I can think of one time in the past year, and he probably doesn't even remember it because he was drunk. I will say that when I'm with him, I try to initiate hand-holding and hugging. Personally, I really need that still. And sometimes he's receptive and sometimes he's not. But there really isn't trust. I don't know how he feels about me in terms of trust. I can tell you that I've become harsh with him because I just can't listen to the denial. I can't listen to the deflection. You know, his problems are all someone else's fault. It has nothing to do with his own actions, nothing to do with his own behavior, and I just can't listen to it.
And you've set a hard boundary about drinking, right? You've said if the relationship is to continue, there needs to be sobriety.
Yeah, well, basically what's happened now is I'm not really communicating with him. Just over the last like 2 weeks, I blocked him because I just can't do it anymore. I told him the end of last year and the beginning of this year, I'm not doing another year of this. I'm just not. I need to see some kind of progress. I'm doing things myself to work on myself and move ahead and attempt to heal from this. He's just not doing anything. And he just can't be part of my life anymore if he's not doing anything. I kind of disagree that it would be easier to start over with someone new. And I think my reasoning for that is I'm not a trusting person. I know what his character is.
Sure.
I'm able to look at him and say, he's two different people. He's himself and he's an addict. And he himself is just a beautiful, beautiful human being. I want to start over with that beautiful human being. I don't want to meet someone new and have to figure out if they're a scumbag or if they're really a good guy. I know he's a good guy.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but definitely coming back from the trust and the denial and the deflection and, you know, trying to spin things on me and make things my fault. And the problem is that I'm controlling and I have anger issues. Well, I have to be controlling. I'm not going to let the drunk be in control. We own the business. He would get drunk at our business. I'm going to let that person be in control when I'm sitting there and I can see that he's making people uncomfortable. I'm going to sit back and let him ruin things even more than they're already ruined?
Yeah. Have you ever had conversations about the relationship and the intimacy? Like, you know, I know that Matt has shared his experiences of how it felt to be rejected, but have you ever had conversations with him about how it is, especially for, I think, a female to be rejected? Because, you know, I think that we just hold so much more responsibility and ownership and much more feelings about that rejection, and would take it so much more personally than like they're just not in the mood. But have you talked about that with him, and how does he respond?
Sherry, that's a great question. I have tried to talk to him about certain things. I have tried to bring up certain topics, including this. And the reaction I get from him sometimes varies. I feel like he has to be in a certain mood to really hear me. And sometimes it goes really okay, and sometimes he gets very defensive. So, you know, that's another thing that makes trust really hard. I'm never exactly sure what reaction I'm going to get.
Well, that sounds like you're dealing with an alcoholic. You never know what exactly you're going to get from us. Yeah, that's very interesting. I'm really glad you're here, Renee, because you represent a side of the story that is not nearly as uncommon as I thought it was originally. But for the non-alcoholic, for the the partner who doesn't have the alcohol problem to be the one with the higher libido, that's actually, it's not the majority. I mean, the majority is Sherry and I's situation, but it's not uncommon at all. And so I'm really glad you're here, because I hope that there are listeners that are thinking, gosh, even though my partner is an alcoholic, I still miss that intimate connection. I still want that intimate connection. And I feel rejected when I try to initiate. Also not uncommon is the situation of a drinker only being comfortable having sexual contact when they're drinking. That's a whole nother kind of topic, but it's one that's been covered in depth in the recovery community. Usually that's, I don't want to say that. It's a very common issue. So you are representing two things that I think a lot of our listeners will be able to relate to. And so we're just really glad you're here to share your story, Renee.
Thank you so much.
We'll come back to you, Renee, but let's bring Nicole in. Nicole, we'd love to hear how alcohol consumption and alcoholism impacted your intimate relationship over time and kind of how that's evolved to where you are now.
Okay. Hi, Matt and Sherry, everybody. So I was nodding along a lot to what Nikki said. My husband was a secret drinker as well, and we've been together for 30 years. So we were not even of age, far below drinking age. So it didn't start back then. It was long after we got together. We always had a great connection. Sex and intimacy, like both was good in the beginning. I couldn't even pinpoint where it, you know, fell apart. It was like the frog in the boiling water, or the, you know, whatever metaphor. I didn't even recognize what was happening. There came eventually, he would get very jealous. He would accuse me of having affairs, or just ridiculous accusations. And of course that would turn me off. But then like his need to confirm or validate that I wasn't having an affair would be to have sex, but that's the last thing I want to do when I'm being accused of doing, of being unfaithful. So there would be pouting and whatever. Usually after a couple of days I'd give in. there, even during the drinking times, there were times where it was still good. Over time, as the drinking escalated again in secret, I'd had no idea, but he became more of the stereotypical, like the behaviors he himself will tell you now, where his appearance, he got sloppy in his appearance. He gained a lot of weight. And there, while I had always been attracted to him before, I was not attracted to this version of him. And so that was hard to accept, but at the same time, I was committed to my marriage. I didn't know I was dealing with an alcoholic, and I, you know, would force myself to continue the intimacy, as not as often as he would want, but often enough that it was, that it wouldn't cause him to pout. So that, I mean, years and years of that. He had, once I discovered he was an alcoholic, it was about 3 years ago, and he got sober and things seemed to get better. And then he started drinking again within a couple of months. That, of course, then affected the intimacy. But again, I didn't know that was the reason, you know, because he swore to me he was sober. So then I think there's something wrong with me, that I'm not attracted to my husband anymore, and I'm the one who needs help. He got sober for a good long time, for about a year and a half. And during that time, the sexual connection came back, and it was more satisfying to both of us. But he was not in recovery, so the safety piece was not there, which, as Nikki talked about, trust and safety, those are crucial. And then he relapsed yet again. And again, I thought I was the crazy one, because I would notice he was gaining weight, and then I'm like, who am I? I'm this horrible person who's just, you know, picking apart my husband. Like, what if I've gained a pound or two? Do I want him pointing it out to me? And he denied through all those, the last relapse that he had was really bad. It escalated very quickly, and he denied it. It's a lot of gaslighting, and you know, and then I really thought I was a horrible person. Then called my mom one night and said, have you ever thought of just leaving dad? Like, have you ever just thought, I can't take it anymore, because I can't take this anymore. And having no idea of what I was still dealing with, an alcoholic. I feel like I've derailed the original question, but
no, you're doing great. You're sharing your story about how intimacy changed over time. So that relapse ended when?
It was 11 months ago, almost, that it ended. So he's been sober for almost 11 months, and he entered recovery this time, and has been in recovery since then, which has made a critical difference between the 18 months he was sober before, where he was the dry drunk that, you know, I didn't know all these words back then, but I know them now. His behavior didn't change. He just didn't have the alcohol to fuel the fire. Now he's working on his character traits. He's acknowledging that he's in AA, and he's working through the 12 steps. And it has made such a critical difference in how he has dealt with me, with our kids, with everything in his life. And I can see that. It helps significantly to build trust. But at the same time, after three relapses, my trust is so shattered that I still struggle a lot with intimacy, and what Nikki mentioned with like little casual touches and stuff like that. We're actually part of your intimacy intervention study group. And I haven't even been able to force myself to do that yet. And part of that is we've had, as you guys know, we lost a close family friend recently, and the grief around that has been just devastating. And so while I'm not feeling unsafe because of my husband, I'm just like, my emotions are all out of whack, and sex is the last thing on my mind. It really is.
this in sobriety and in recovery, does he understand that? Because I have to say, for me, it's taken a lot of work for me to come to grips with the fact that for Sherry, your desire for intimacy and ability to go there is really related to outside things outside of the relationship. You can have a bad day or something tragic can happen, has nothing to do with me. And that is not on your mind. Intimacy is no longer on your mind. And I would have taken that as an insult or an affront originally. And now I've learned, well, you know, this is, you know, I'm much better at compartmentalizing. I can say, yes, this tragic thing happened, but oh, by the way, we're both going to lay down and go to sleep anyway. So, you know, why don't we get it on? I'm curious, is there more of an understanding of your side of things in his recovery this time around?
In the last few weeks, yes, it's been really nice. Maybe months. Time has kind of been a blur lately. But so, for example, on a couple nights ago, the kids were both going to be out really late, and our son has been, he's participating in something. He's got him coming home like after 11, and I try to go to bed at 9. So, I thought, okay, we're going to be up waiting for him. Kids are gone. I'm going to, you know, maybe when I want to be awake, we can make something happen. Well, then we had this horrible storm and all this hail. And I didn't share that those are my thoughts with him, but he could recognize in me that, okay, there's nothing sexy is going on tonight, because we got Mother Nature's making sure that doesn't happen. But he has been much more considerate in the last probably month or two of recognizing when either if one of our kids is not doing well, he actually pays attention to how it's affecting me and then doesn't try to initiate anything, which is comforting, because then I don't feel like I have to perform and I don't feel like I'm letting him down if I say no when I don't feel like it. Because he's recognizing that the mind and in a woman, your mind has to be in the right place for the body.
That's
right.
Yeah, that was such a relief when that finally connected to Matt. Because, like, if you know, probably that night you had Mother Nature, but you also had your children out of the house. They're teenagers, mm-hmm. but they're out of the house. So then you're worried about, well, how's that going to affect their driving and their ability to get home?
Oh,
so
the weather.
Yeah, the weather with that, you know, that's what I meant by Mother Nature. But
yeah,
you know, so I appreciate now that I can say, no, I'm not interested to Matt, even if I don't feel like I have to explain to him. I mean, you're picking up on what's going on around the house and in, you know, so you can be more respectful of my no's, and I feel more safe saying, no, I'm not interested, without having to validate and defend that.
Well, this is such an important part of the conversation, because the obvious thing that happens in sobriety and recovery, especially as time starts to build, is that the behavior gets better and we stop, you know, acting like an asshole, basically. Unrelated to intimacy, just we start behaving better. And so that's something that, you know, you might think, oh, well, that's more attractive. So you get that going for you. But the other thing that happens in sobriety and longer term recovery is our awareness improves. And so when people are working on relationship repair and there's still active drinking taking place, this is one of the many reasons that it just feels like, you know, you're wasting your time until you get sobriety, because how can you be aware? How can I pick up what you're putting down? How can I worry about the fact that you're grieving the loss of someone close to the family and there's a hailstorm and the kids are out in it? How can you pick up on that when drinking is still such a big part of your life? Not only are you very selfish and behaving poorly, but you just can't, you're not aware of what anyone else is thinking. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. I think that's really important as it ties into intimacy, Nicole. I want to come back to what happens next. Hang on. I'm going to talk for a minute.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Okay. Hang on. We're going to leave another pause. Do you need to clear again? Or are you okay?
Huh.
Okay. So let's move on to the next little kind of piece of this that we want to talk about. Sherry and I have come to believe that there are really two foundational components to relationship recovery, to intimacy recovery. And it's stuff that we've talked a little bit about, which is really cool. Safety is one of them. There has to be a safe environment. You know, that has to do with not so much physical safety. I don't think we're necessarily talking about relationships where physical safety has been in question, although their safety needs to return if that is the case as well. But we're talking about emotional safety. We're talking about trust. We're talking about nervous system regulation. We're talking about not constantly being on eggshells and worried about big swings in moods and attitudes. And so just feeling a calm and peaceful environment, that has, for Sherry and I, that's been a really huge foundational component to intimacy repair. The other piece of this, though, that I think is really important and foundational is recognizing that no one is sexually broken. We have four women on this call and one guy, that's me. And I think it's probably fairly representative in that of the four women, three of you have a lower libido than your partner, and one of you has higher than your partner. I think that, you know, obviously there's nothing statistically significant about four people, but 75 to 25% is, that's probably not too terribly far off. And so, but one thing that is for sure is there's nobody on this call who has the exact same level of libido or sexual desire as their partner, because desire discrepancy is pretty much a universal thing. It goes one way or the other. There's a common way. There's an also totally normal, slightly less common way, but desire discrepancy is a real thing. And it was a big barrier for Sherry and I, because like you said earlier, you thought I was just selfish and greedy and horny and all those other words, right? Mm-hmm. And I thought you were prudish and selfish and just mean-spirited because you did reject me a lot. And so we had to come to grips with the fact that desire discrepancy doesn't mean either of us is broken. Just because I want it more than you do doesn't mean there's anything wrong with me. And just because you want it less doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you. In fact, we've gone so far to start to talk about exactly how often we do want it. Should we go there, Sherry?
Yeah, I don't care. Yeah, you can do that.
Well, you're going to have to participate as well.
I know, it's a little embarrassing to talk about.
It's a tough topic, no question. But you've done it before. Are you willing to go? You're willing to? Okay, great. So we don't have to edit this part out?
No.
At least not yet? So if I was the king of the world and I was in charge of all decision-making in our relationship, we would have sex, I figure, about 10 times a week. That might seem like a lot. We've shared this in other forums, and I've seen people immediately go in their head to, well, there's only 7 days a week. How do you even do that? There's only seven nights. Well, let me do the math for you. I figure out of 7 nights, I probably want to have sex 6 of the 7 nights, probably one night where I would legitimately be too tired, or Sherry would go to bed at a different time than I would, and it just wouldn't match up. So, but 6 out of the 7 nights, I figure on average would be about right. And then there would probably be 3 mornings where I'd wake up and be like, you know what would be great before getting out of bed? A little boom boom time, don't you think, Sherry? So that's 9. And then, you know, just one kind of random kitchen table episode at some point throughout the week, I figure. So that's how I get to 10. Sherry, if you were king of the world and you got to decide all things related to sex and intimacy in our relationship, how many times a week would we have sex?
I guess it would depend on the week.
Yeah. On average, then.
Maybe about once.
Once a week?
Yeah, once a week.
Now, how does that contrast with how many times a week you wanted to have sex back when I was drinking?
Oh, well, I didn't want to have sex at all.
So we're up to 1 from 0.
Yeah.
That's pretty great.
Yeah.
And so so our work in recovery, once we've created the safe environment, and let me ask a follow up. So I'm 10, you're 1. I don't think there's anything wrong with you. I think that's very normal. That's very normal and healthy. What do you think about me, Sherry?
10 is a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Our kitchen table couldn't hold us because it's pretty weak. It's got a couple crappy legs. It's just kind of propped against the kitchen wall. I mean, I don't want to make anybody feel bad, but I think 10 is still high.
So you're struggling with the no one is sexually broken part of our...
Yeah, I guess I'm fine with whatever everybody else wants to do, but, you know, 10 in your own relationship, when it is 10 to 1, that is a challenge. That's a big challenge.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't know. Like, I'm sure 10 is not broken. 10 is your king of the world. You could have everything you want.
Right.
So I guess that I know that it's not reality. It's doable. You can think all you want.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I think the point is, you know, we have accepted each other as, we've got our own, you know, libidos, our own, feelings about sexual desire, and there's nothing wrong with you. I don't say you're a prude and you need to be a better wife. And, you know, there's something you need to go to the doctor because there's something wrong and you need to get on medication and you need to fix that. You feel the way you feel, and I'm good with that. And you're sort of good with how I feel, apparently.
Well, at least you're not arguing to get all 10 in a week. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
So that's good. So that's our work in recovery. That's something that we have to negotiate. But recognizing those two foundations is really important. So what I want to ask you guys is, how do you feel about those two foundations? The fact that their safety is important and that whatever the desire is, your partner and nor you, neither of you are broken. Nikki, can we come back to you?
Yeah. So.
I'm not asking you to give your numbers, by the way. You don't have to give your numbers or your partner's number.
Well, I just wanted to... I'm just going to say I'm with Sherry on that one. Once a week would be fine. So I've heard this phrase and it works for me. And it's that I believe that foreplay begins at the end of the last orgasm, which means that for me, and I think for a lot of women, what you're doing for me during the day is going to determine what I'm doing for you at night. So if, you know, you're not there for me, you're not listening to me, you're walking away from me when I'm trying to talk to you, I'm asking you to do something, you're ignoring, you know, all those things, like, I'm not going to have any sexy feelings for you. So it's, you know, it has nothing to do with my husband. I mean, I could just look at him a certain way and he's like, all right, let's go right now. I mean, he's like right now kind of thing. So that's really sort of different, but that is where the safety comes in. So when I don't feel safe during the day, when I don't trust you during the day, when you're not paying any attention to me at all in a loving way, like I don't need tons of attention, but when I'm talking to you, like I would like you to listen and I would like you to remember the things that I'm saying to you the next day. So when you're drunk, you're not listening to me, you're not remembering, and those resentments and frustrations build. And that's what causes the safety to go away and the trust to go away. I don't trust him to take care of me anymore as a human. Like maybe I don't need to be physically taken care of, but I need to be emotionally taken care of. And that's where everything starts breaking, I think. So, because sex is more of an emotional thing for me, not a physical thing. So if I'm not emotionally into it, I don't need it and I don't want it. So my husband, it's the opposite for him. So in order to feel those emotional feelings, he needs to get that physical release first. That's what he says. He's learning to do something different now. We're both learning to do something different now, which is good. So as far as Nobody's broken. My husband used to accuse me that I weaponized sex, that I was using it to control him. So it was all up to me, and I made all the rules around sex in our house. So I got to decide. I was in charge, and I was controlling him in that way. That's what he said to me. That's not what was happening. What was happening was that I was slowly over time wanting less and less sex because I was less attracted to him, less safety, less trust, all of those things. But the way he saw it was I was controlling him with that. So I became the bad person. I was the broken person because, according to him, because he was not allowed to make those decisions in our household. I had to be the one to initiate sex every time this is coming from him, right? I mean, it's warped, right? So he was drunk, so it's warped. But, you know, every time he would initiate sex, I would push him away. He liked to say that I would give him the elbow, like physically, like elbow him, which I never did. I don't know where he came up with that, but he would just make a lot of excuses as to why I was the broken person, which made me feel horrible. I started to believe it. Over time of years of him telling me this, I started thinking I was broken. And I think I'm still now sort of dealing with that. Like, am I broken? Because we're having all these issues trying to reconnect now. And I'm the one having the hardest time with it. So I thought the same thing as Sherry, that he was a horny bastard and just, you know, get off me. Like, just leave me alone. You're gross. And all I am is a piece of meat to you. Because emotionally, I was getting zero. All he wanted was the physical part of me. So I just felt like a complete piece of meat. Like, I could have been anyone, put any face on this body, and it would have been just fine. And so, yeah, I did think he was broken too. And now I see that differently. I don't think that he's broken. I think he was just begging for connection in any way that he could get it. And I don't think he wanted to do that with anyone else. I think it is with just me. So we're getting there. I'm learning, but it's difficult. And I still think, you know, like, once a week would be great. If we could get there, that'd be amazing. One time a week. I mean, I would compromise, you know, maybe a little more, but 10, no, thank you. Mm-mm. Nope.
Well, you brought together so many important things. First of all, the foreplay starts at the end of the last orgasm. That's Esther Perel. I want to give her credit for that. And I'm really impressed that you remember that. That's so important. This is about compartmentalization versus compilation. And it sounds like there's so many similarities in your relationship, but I could totally compartmentalize the things that happened through the day, right? All the things that you're talking about, where the safety needed to be, the emotional safety throughout the day. I can put those all in separate little boxes. And then when it's go time, I'm ready to have sex. For Sherry, it's exactly like you, Nikki, and Esther have said. It's how are you treating me in between? And that is so, so, so important. The degree to which that is common and the degree to which I think our listeners are going to relate cannot be, you know, exaggerated. And I think the fact that you've come around to the point where you respect his desire, you have your own sexual desire, and you recognize that there's nothing wrong with either of those. They're not broken is really good. I think maybe the most important point that you hit on, though, was that when you're the person with the less desire, less sexual desire, you do control things to a great degree. And I think that that's important to acknowledge. But it's not necessarily wrong. I know there are other people out there in the recovery community and in the couples, you know, relationship community that talk about just throwing them a bone, like you talked about earlier, And I've heard the, you know, the use of the Nike slogan, just do it, whether you want to or not. I think that's tremendously damaging to relationships. It certainly has been to ours. And that would never be our recommendation. What needs to happen from, if you're the me in this scenario, if you're the person that is more interested in more frequent intimacy, you need to go out and earn it. You need to be respectful throughout the day. You need to be curious about what your partner is up to. You need to have conversations, even when you're not a very talkative person. You need to do that emotional connection, because I respect what your husband says. The emotional connection comes from the physical connection, but it doesn't have to. I can be a really supportive, loving, caring, questioning, curious husband for Sherry. And then, you know, she might open up and she might be interested in the physical connection more often. It's not the other way around. It's not that you have to give it to me and then I'll get the emotional connection and you're holding all the cards otherwise. Yes, it's true that the person that wants it less is more of a decision maker. But rather than me just pouting about that, I can go out and earn it. I can work really hard to be the kind of husband that my wife wants me to be. And then, you know, intimacy, both emotional and physical, improves as a result. And I definitely think that's the way to go. But that guilt that you talk about around feeling like maybe I am the one that's broken at the same time as you, to use your words, think that your husband's a horny bastard. I mean, you've just, you know, described the issue very, very well. It's a big deal. So thank you very much, Nikki. Renee, what's your reaction to the idea that safety is important in the relationship and that no one is sexually broken?
So I definitely agree with both of those. I think safety and communication are probably the two most important things for the relationship as a whole. So it's certainly important to have good intimacy. I'm kind of reflecting on, Nikki, what you said, and Matt, what you said about the person with the lower libido is kind of controlling the pace, because I've always felt that he would use sex and intimacy as a way to control the relationship, specifically as a way to push me away. Because I think I mentioned I would try to initiate and I would get rejected. So I definitely felt like it was a control tactic on his part. And that combined with a lot of the denial and I feel like it did definitely put like a negative tone on the relationship. I really wanted that intimacy with him. I wanted to feel that connection. So, yeah, I felt very rejected, and I felt like it was him almost using that to try and sabotage the relationship a bit. But maybe that wasn't the case. Maybe, I don't know. It's something for me to think about for sure.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that here you and I, Renee, we're looking at each other and I'm totally relating to you. That rejection is super painful. When you're the one with the higher libido, that rejection hurts. And, you know, it can cause downward spirals of in the relationship, intimacy and otherwise. And my guess is, you know, I would be surprised if your partner used that intentionally as a control tactic. I'm sure I 100% agree with you with the way it feels. I'm sure it feels that way. I doubt it was, you know, premeditated. It's just when the desire isn't there, it isn't there. And but it doesn't take away your pain though.
But then he would get drunk and be interested at that point. And I feel like that was really negative for me because, as I mentioned, that's when I was the least attracted to him. It's when he was the least able to, I don't know, kind of do what I would like him to do. And it almost felt like there was maybe something wrong with maybe I was asking for something weird or something that wasn't typical, even though, I mean, I'm pretty vanilla, honestly. Like, I wasn't asking for anything, you know, totally crazy or off the charts. But, yeah, that definitely eroded the safety in the relationship, too.
Yeah.
And I felt bad about myself for giving in at that point. But I felt like if I didn't give in, who knows when it would have happened. I feel like I almost didn't have a choice but to give in. If I wanted a sexual relationship with him, I kind of had to give in when he was offering, when he was a sloppy drunk.
What a painful experience. Both of you are experiencing pain in different ways. And I got a ton of empathy for the pain that you're describing, Renee. That's a tough spot to be in for sure. Nicole, how about you? Do you want to take a stab at this? The two foundations, safety and no one is sexually broken. What do you think about that?
Well, I probably felt sexually broken for a while, especially with the gaslighting and everything going on, you know, and the fact that our libidos were so discrepant for so many years. It's very hard to rebuild now, as I said earlier, and the trust issue. I mean, I agree with foreplay starts. I mean, it just never ends. If you want it to continue, if you want the relationship, the intimacy, the sex to continue, then the foreplay never ends. And a lot of that has to do with interest in, as Nikki was saying, like, show interest in me. Don't walk away when I'm talking to you. You know, remember what I say. Even in sobriety, that's an issue. And that is a major trigger for me because I'm like, we talked about this yesterday and now you don't remember that happened. I mean, that was an everyday occurrence when he's drinking. So then it's constantly, are you drinking again? And then I feel unsafe. And then I'm not, you know, it's just a vicious cycle. And I think my least favorite thing that I hear in Echoes is it just takes time because I can remember being, you know, just a newborn in this recovery world 10 months ago, like, you know, 1 month in or 2 months in and thinking, but it's been 2 months and I've been putting up with this for so many years. What do you mean more time? And now here we are at 11 months and I'm like, it just takes time. And it's so frustrating. I think so the more I learn about No One Is Sexually Broken and the book that we're reading, or we started and we haven't continued, or the intimacy intervention, I do believe it. I can see it. Don't necessarily like feel it yet, you know? I don't know. It's a hard thing.
It is coming back. And I think this ties into one of the things that we've been talking a lot about, the fact that intimacy and trust are so related. When we talk about the importance of safety, that safety is all about trust. And trust and intimacy are the last things to come back in an alcoholic relationship that reaches sobriety and where recovery work is being done. And the fact that trust and intimacy are tied together, that means, you know, this is kind of the last bastion. It's the thing you're working toward. And it does take a lot of time. The book that you're referencing is called Come As You Are by Dr. Emily Nagoski. And, you know, anyone who is still listening this deep into this podcast, you have enough interest in the subject that I want to strongly recommend that book to you. It was life-changing for you and I, Sherry. What What were a couple of your takeaways from Come As You Are?
Learning about the brakes and accelerators, as Nicole was speaking the first time talking about that, that awareness that each partner has about what is maybe going to be a stop. Like maybe we have, maybe you and I, Matt, have talked about having a sexual and, you know, intimate night, but something happens earlier in the day and derails it. Like, you know, so maybe there, we find out some bad news about an extended family member or one of the kids, like something happens and we have to go get them because a car broke down,
or they're out, like, in a hailstorm,
or they're out in a hailstorm, you know, like those are things that is going to like turn me off. Whereas before, you, like you had mentioned, like you can compartmentalize even still, but now you're aware that we have the, we have those brakes and accelerators, and that, that was probably like the biggest. And then number two is that arousal response. Like you obviously with your 10 times of 10 times 10,
baby, 10 times a week
encounters a week, obviously sex is on your mind a lot more. Whereas I don't think about it one iota until we discuss whether or not we're going to have sex that evening. So like, but on your understanding and my understanding that when I do make like a, you know, bid for connection, that I'm not going to be like ready on the spot, but it takes some time. And yes, it's foreplay, but then that arousal response like happens. And I think it's just being a 52-year-old woman, like my hormones are different. I don't have this desire to procreate, whereas men, they can just procreate forever.
Yeah.
God forbid.
There's a lot behind that. There's a whole tie to natural selection and evolution.
So,
and
so that understanding,
you know, you've had a baby. My inner body doesn't know that I've already procreated. So I just never want to stop procreating.
Yeah. So, yeah. So those like medical terms and that awareness and that connection, I think, has made all the difference. And of course, like your sobriety.
Yeah.
Has, you know, been helpful.
Yeah. So you're a fan of the book. Helped us a lot. Another thing you just alluded to, which you're kind of making breaking news here, Sherry, on this episode. You said that when we talk about sex at night, that's something we've been doing. Gosh, how long have we been doing that now? 9 months, a year? Has it been a year?
I don't know.
For a long time now, every single night we talk about sex. Every single night. And it is such an amazing relief to take something that's so taboo. I used to lay there and hope that she would initiate, or hope that she would be responsive if I would initiate. There's all this mystery around it. That's ridiculous. That's a ridiculous way to live your life. This needs to not be a taboo subject anymore, the way it traditionally has been in our society. So now every single night we talk about whether or not we are interested in having sex. And what has happened that I think is fascinating is more often than not, I don't say how I feel and you say how you feel. We answer for each other. I'll say, I can tell, you know, you had a stressful day and it's late and you're tired. I can tell you're not interested, Sherry. And you'll usually say, yes, you're right. Way to pick up what I'm laying down.
Yeah.
And sometimes you'll say,
good on you for being aware.
Yeah. Well, and you're pretty good at it too. Sometimes you'll say,
that's you. I always just say, you'll say yes.
Well, but you'll say sometimes
10 times a week, we got to get it in.
It's been a little while and I know you've had a stressful day and I know, you know, some of the same things, but they have the opposite reaction.
Yeah.
So you say, you know, I think we should do something tonight because I can tell, you know, that would help you. And so it's, you know, I thought that this was going to be a negotiation when we talked every night. It's not. It's like, it's a mutual understanding. It's really been life changing.
Yeah.
So that's a big part. That's a topic for a whole nother podcast down the road, but improving communication around, all issues, physical intimacy, emotional intimacy. It's just so, so important. And I just want to thank our guests. I want to thank all three of you for coming on and talking about a really, really difficult subject. Just to let our listeners in on a little inside information, we had a period in our Echoes of Recovery group 2 months ago now
where this was a topic for a couple of weeks in a row. And I feel like we really got some momentum going and everyone in the group was getting comfortable talking about intimacy. And then we scheduled this podcast recording for 2 months later. And my guess is that we haven't had a lot of conversations. Our guests haven't had a lot of conversations about this since. And for you to come on early on this morning and go there, I know it's not easy. And I know, you know, this was not the maybe the smoothest podcast we've ever had, but I think the information that was delivered is really, really important. And I'm just really thankful that you guys were willing to have a conversation that I think the vast, vast majority of the population isn't willing to do. So Nikki, Renee, Nicole, thank you very much for being on the Untoxicated podcast and talking about such a difficult thing. We appreciate it.
Before you go, we hope you'll consider these three resources.
If you love or loved an alcoholic, we offer support and connection in our Echoes of Recovery group. Check us out at echoesofrecovery.org.
If you are a high-functioning alcoholic seeking methods and connection in early sobriety, we're ready for you at shoutsobriety.org.
No matter who you are, there's something for you in our book, Sober Evolution, Evolve into Sobriety and Recover Your Alcoholic Marriage. Go to soberevolution.org.
For my wife, Sherry Salas, I'm Matt Salas. Thanks for listening to the Untoxicated Podcast.